It's Thursday, February 25th. What will it take to become America's third COVID vaccine? We start here. No more tears. Johnson & Johnson says it's got the goods.
Nobody in the clinical trial who got this vaccine died or was hospitalized, which is pretty incredible.
Ahead of a monster hearing, we'll go over just how effective this vaccine is and why its numbers are different from the others. There's never been a better time to claim something got lost in the mail.
How much longer are you planning to stay?
A long time. Get used to me.
So why is the leadership at the U.S. Postal Service so comfortable? There are new developments overnight. And kids idolize the players with the best stats, at least the stats they know about.
It kind of clicks for you and you say, okay, well, that's exactly how great Oscar Charleston was.
From now on, players in the Negro Leagues will be on those lists. So how does it shape how we see the game? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. We currently have two COVID-19 vaccines available in the United States, Pfizer and Moderna. It has been that way since the end of December.
This nation does not have enough supply of the vaccine, period.
Even as cities and states told the federal government they needed more doses, there was this limited supply, and even though some vaccines had been approved elsewhere, no drug maker has been able to come to the FDA with a vaccine saying, "We are ready to be judged. Give us that emergency use authorization." That changes tomorrow, when Johnson & Johnson will face questions from a panel hoping to become the third vaccine to be used in the U.S.
It's great to begin with promising news for a change. The news today on the Johnson & Johnson one-shot vaccine.
Yesterday, Johnson & Johnson made their data public. So, how are we looking, and could we be about to take a new leap forward as a nation? Sony Salzman is a producer with ABC's medical unit, where she focuses on vaccine development. Sony, you've had your eye on J&J specifically. Like, you've been in conversations with them. What do you see in the data?
So what we saw in the data here, and believe me, it was more than 200 pages to dig through, but what we saw was some really promising data about how well this vaccine, which is only one shot, protects you against severe illness.
The vaccine results reported today show very high efficacy against severe disease. There was 85% efficacy against severe disease all throughout the world, in the U.S., in Brazil and Latin America, as well as in South Africa.
The top line here is that this vaccine is 85% effective against severe disease, and it's 100% effective against preventing deaths and hospitalizations. What that means is that nobody in the clinical trial who got this vaccine died or was hospitalized, which is pretty incredible.
Another key finding, the report saying the single dose vaccine may also prevent some asymptomatic disease when you don't even know you have it, which means it could help reduce the spread of the virus.
What vaccines are meant to do is not only protect you from getting infected in the first place, that's the hope, but really the big kahuna here is protecting you from getting sick so you don't clog up those hospitals. We don't drain, you can still stay at work. You know, there's so many benefits of protecting you from severe illness. So that's what we mean when we say 85%.
Well, and so 85% effective, awesome. We also see Moderna and Pfizer, they say they're over 90% effective, right? So does that mean that they're better than this Johnson & Johnson one? Does it matter?
You know, I get that question a lot. And I would say that even though you're seeing different numbers and the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines appear to be higher, these numbers, you can't compare them directly. There's a lot of different reasons here. So Johnson & Johnson is only one shot. Moderna and Pfizer are two. That could be something at play here. But really, the real reason is that we live in a different world today than we were living in back when the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines were tested over the summer.
As of yesterday, we have confirmed 1,277 cases of the B.1.1.7 variant across 42 states.
Back then, we didn't have these new variants. We were in a different stage of the pandemic.
In the past week, average daily cases declined 25%.
So to approximately the bottom line here is that for the Johnson & Johnson shot, it protected a lot of people from illness and disease. And we should all be very encouraged by that. I don't think that the average person should walk around comparing these numbers and saying, oh, well, we're hearing the 90s for Pfizer and Moderna. I want that one. All of them are going to protect you from severe illness, which is what scientists are telling us is the metric we need to focus on.
Right. And I was hearing from an epidemiologist saying, you know, when we think about 90% effective, you think, oh, one out of 10 people, this just isn't going to work for. So, like, is it even worth my time? Well, they were saying that is the wrong way to think about it, because if lots of people get the vaccine, there's less disease even swirling around you in the first place. And so your chances of going to the hospital now go way, way down. We're not talking about one out of 10 chance. We're talking one out of 100, one out of 1,000. So it's a big deal. That kind of thing, Sony, like that kind of success, is there a chance that we are underselling the value of these vaccines? When the CDC says, well, I don't know if you should really take your mask off because you got the vaccine, is there an actual detriment to actually being too conservative in the way officials hype this up to people?
Yeah, so, you know, this is really interesting. This is where the tension between science and public health and the general public really comes to a head, because scientists and public health people are really careful people. They only want to say exactly what they know and nothing more.
And he's now saying experts should level with the public about the good news. Your reaction to that?
Well, the numbers are coming down, George. When you look at the daily curves and the 7-day averages, as you're showing on the screen there, it's dramatically down with a sharp deflection. We've got to be really careful and not.
So the mask question is a great example. We suspect, because of our years of history with vaccines and viruses, that if you're vaccinated, you're not going to pass that virus along to someone else.
I don't believe we're going to be able to throw the masks away and forget about physical separation and congregate settings for a while, probably likely.
Until, but because it hasn't been definitively proven yet for this disease, our public health officials, including the CDC, are saying keep that mask on. But it leads to this kind of conflicting message where I think people are confused and frustrated. So, Brad, maybe there is something to this that, you know, public health officials are being very, I think, cautious. I think it's good to have caution and only say what you know that's proven by the data.
Like the CDC also says, like, don't eat cookie dough raw. Like they also tell you that.
That's right. The CDC also tells you not to eat raw cookie dough. And you know what? Sometimes people do. So I am certainly not advocating that anyone go out there and, you know, throw caution to the wind and ignore CDC guidance. I think it's important. And I do value having that data to support all of your decisions. But we're waiting for data to accumulate for things that we feel pretty sure will ultimately end up being true.
So let's say that Johnson & Johnson vaccine gets this emergency use authorization, and if it's anywhere close to Pfizer and Moderna, you'd think that it would, because they pass with flying colors, basically. The plan has been, all right, great, like get it flowing, right? Like get people lined up and injected, and yet it sounds like there are already problems with the supply of this vaccine we're still waiting for.
Yeah, so that's true. There have been issues with the supply.
We were surprised to learn that Johnson & Johnson was behind on their manufacturing. As you noted, it was kind of reported earlier to be about 10 million, and now it's more like 3 to 4 million doses that they would be ready to ship.
You know, months and months ago, when they were first making these projections, they thought a certain thing. Then they got up in there and tried to scale up manufacturing, and reality hit. So there's good news, bad news here. The bad news is that fresh out of the gate, we're probably only going to have 4 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine readily available right at the moment that they get authorized.
Yeah, I think they're in a better place now. We've helped them with equipment and raw materials.
Now, the good news is that what the company has said is that by the end of March, they can have 20 million doses, which is great. And remember, for this vaccine, 20 million doses equals 20 million people, right? It's a one-dose shot. And the company is still on track for that 100 million doses by June, July, summertime.
Yeah, just super useful information, Sony. And actually, one other piece of news I think everyone can use. The CDC yesterday put out a new study showing just how important masks are at your local gym. Like at one gym in Chicago, people were doing those high-intensity training classes indoors. Most were not wearing masks. And out of 81 people, 55 of them had COVID at the time. Many of them not wearing masks, potentially spreading it to others. Sony Salzman, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brad.
A couple days ago, I opened a package, which was a Valentine's Day gift from my mom. Which, is it weird to get a Valentine's Day gift from your mom? I don't know. That's a different conversation. The point is, This box had taken 2 weeks to arrive. And this has become a common thing across the country. People are still receiving Christmas presents. It is very common at this point to hear your neighbors asking, what is wrong with the post office? Like, if your job is to get stuff to a place on time and you don't, that's a bad business model.
Let me say at the outset that we must acknowledge that during this peak season, we fell far short of meeting our service targets.
And yet, the man in charge of the post office says he feels no pressure to his job. In fact, yesterday when he was called in front of Congress, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy said he's not going anywhere. ABC's Lucian Brueggemann has been covering the nightmare known as the modern post office. Luke, I mean, how bad has it gotten at the Postal Service where Congress needs to call you in to yell at you?
It's not good, Brad, at the Postal Service. And the hearing was combative. It reflected that. And that's just, I think, mostly a result of the fact that the Postal Service is such a beloved agency. So many people rely on it for things from medication to checks, but also because DeJoy is so controversial, the Postmaster General.
You're a political appointee, a holdover. No one knows how much longer your board...
That's incorrect. I'm not a political appointee. I was selected by a bipartisan board of governors, and I would really appreciate if you would get that straight.
Well, how much longer are you planning to stay?
A long time. Get used to me.
He's so inextricably linked to the Trump administration. He's been on the job for less than a year.
The new Postmaster General, a major donor to the president's campaign.
He wants to make the post office great again.
Democrats call it a deliberate effort to sabotage the expected surge in mail-in voting.
And as you might expect, this hearing sort of became a venue for lawmakers to sort of air grievances about the election. But since then, Brad, things at the Postal Service have really deteriorated, as you mentioned. Major delays around the holiday season, which is something that DeJoy actually apologized for yesterday.
Too many Americans were left waiting for weeks for important deliveries of mail and packages. This is unacceptable, and I apologize to those customers who felt the impact of our delays.
Right, and I want to ask you more about the leadership in a second, but first of all, can you just explain to me why it does seem like a piece of mail is taking that much longer to cross the country? Like, what is going wrong?
Yeah, it's a good question, Brad. To begin, the Postal Service has struggled financially for years, and advocates will tell you that not enough resources have gone to the agency, which, again, is very popular and important to so many Americans. But the pandemic really presented a double whammy that exacerbated these existing challenges.
Significant air capacity was lost. Significant transportation capacity was lost.
Americans just started online shopping a lot, sending packages across the country.
I had 200% more orders than I normally get, and I'm dealing with COVID also. We have the same problems as everybody else does. The post office has the same problems as everybody else does, but everybody else does their job.
And then you also have the pandemic affecting personnel.
More than 100 postal workers across the country have died of coronavirus.
It's scary to come to work.
At one point, the Postal Service said as many as 20,000 postal workers were in quarantine at the same time last year. So that's a significant amount of their workforce that's sort of out of pocket.
So essentially, it's been Christmas all year round at the plant. We don't have near the staff we need.
And that's all the basis for these problems. And you add on to that an election in which more Americans than ever before cast their ballot by mail.
They delivered 4.6 billion pieces of election and political mail and ensured that 99.89% of mail ballots were sent back to election officials.
And then even on top of that, you have a holiday season in which fewer families are meeting in person, opting instead, again, to send packages to one another. So all of these circumstances sort of merged at once in a, I guess you would call it a perfect storm of mail delays. And that's kind of how we got where we are now.
President Biden called for you to resign, Mr. DeJoy?
No, the president has not called for me to resign.
Any member of your board called for you to resign?
No, sir.
Well, so then if DeJoy is the face of that, if he's not acting with enough urgency, whatever, I've heard people say, like, okay, fire him. Like, he's the CEO, he's doing badly, fire him. Can Joe Biden do that?
No, and that's actually the source of a lot of confusion.
I'm here until I can see it tangibly produce the results we intended to.
An incoming president can't fire the Postmaster General the way they can in a normal cabinet position. That responsibility lies with the Board of Governors. The Postal Service has this group of people who oversee its operations. And right now, there are 5 members of the board. All, by the way, are Trump appointees, though by law, it has to be bipartisan. So there are 2 Democrats.
The Board of Governors believes the Postmaster General, in very difficult circumstances, is doing a good job.
But there can be as many as nine at a time. And so the approach that Democrats who are critical of DeJoy are taking is to kind of ratchet up this pressure campaign on Joe Biden to appoint new members to basically dilute the board, who would, in theory, then outvote the sitting governors and remove DeJoy.
Oh, wait, this is like when we talk about like packing the Supreme Court, like, hey, Joe Biden could just, you know, bring in like it could be a 15 member court. Like, that's what they're saying you should actually do with the postal board of governors.
It's exactly right, Brad. And actually, just yesterday, Brad, we started seeing reports that Biden is planning to announce three new governors to that oversight board. So the wheels are in motion.
OK, so like what's going to happen and what happens to my mail?
If you ask Louis DeJoy that question, he'll tell you that a major overhaul is definitely still needed. And based on the hearing yesterday, there does seem to be some bipartisan appetite for that in Congress as well.
Above all, my message is that the status quo is acceptable to no one, because the solutions are within reach if we can agree to work together.
He was pitching lawmakers on this 10-year plan he's put together, or is in the process of putting together, that he's planning to roll out by the end of March. It may tweak some delivery standards. Some mail might be slowed down, like first-class mail.
You're basically saying because the mail has been late under your leadership, so we're just going to change the standards and build it into the system that it will be late.
So the standards have not been met. The 3 to 5 day standards have been running at 80% for years.
But he is committing to 6 and 7 day delivery, meaning they'll be on the road 6 or 7 days a week, and an improvement to infrastructure, which we saw the first step yesterday towards that in the announcement of that new fleet of trucks.
To the constituent who complains that their medications haven't arrived on time, I should not go to them and just say, the trucks ran on time. Don't worry, the trucks ran on time.
You are correct, and we agree with you.
Thank you.
But Brad, to your point about getting packages, that's unclear. This could remain an issue for the Postal Service moving forward. You could still see delays, and it seemed like lawmakers expressed some frustration that that was a reality.
Yeah, frustrating for a lot of people. All right. Lucian Brueggemann, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, when it comes to baseball's all-time greatest players, the list you grew up with were wrong. Stretch time. We're back in a bit. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November, and while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
You might remember last year, in the wake of the killing of George Floyd and others, large organizations were being held to account by their own workers. That included sports leagues.
To be honest with you, I don't even want to talk about football right now. That's the thing that I don't even know what that looks like down the road or anything else.
Players were saying, no, forget allowing us to kneel and protest during the anthem. Like, we're beyond that. What are you actually going to do as a league to rectify the wrongs of the past?
Finally tonight, the thousands of baseball players, America Strong, now.
where they belong.
One move from Major League Baseball was to recognize its role in segregation, that it was a whites-only policy that led to the creation of the Negro Leagues, and the least it can do now is to recognize that a home run hit in those leagues was every bit as valid as a home run hit by someone on the Yankees.
Their stats, their records, some 3,400 players will now join Major League Baseball's official record books.
So Major League Baseball said it would now incorporate Negro League stats. Those stats from 1920 to 1948 would now go into the record books, along with the American League, the National League. That's a lot harder than it sounds, especially when you're talking about a sport that relies so much on numbers to define itself. And so our partners at 538 said, "We love numbers, we love baseball," and today they're unveiling their own revamped look at the stats we should all know, the real story of baseball history. 538's Neil Payne has been leading this effort. Neil, I mean, what is this project?
Yeah, so on the site today, you can kind of go to this interactive that we are launching where it's kind of two parts. One part is to help people get more familiar with the greatest players from the Negro Leagues by showing who the most valuable players were and how they compare with the players that should have been their peers, the Hall of Famers from throughout history. The other part is when you scroll down the page, we also created this similarity score algorithm where we use statistics from the Negro Leagues and rate them in terms of what their strengths were. And then we can match those strengths to players that you know better probably from the current day.
Henry Louis Aaron grew up poor in Alabama, where he had to make his own baseball bats with tree limbs. It was when black athletes were lucky if they could make it to the Negro Leagues, which were separate and certainly not equal to the majors.
So baseball fans, they probably know Satchel Paige. They might know Josh Gibson, this really prolific home run hitting catcher. They probably don't know names beyond those two. They don't know Oscar Charleston, for instance.
He said he never saw a center fielder who could go back on a ball the way Charleston could. Uncanny instincts.
2-2.
Who was essentially Mike Trout.
At the wall, Trout leaps up, and he got it! Oh, my! Are you serious?
By making those comparisons, you can instantly sort of say, it kind of clicks for you, and you say, okay, well, that's exactly how great Oscar Charleston was. That's exactly how great Dobie Moore was.
That's right down the middle, and Lindor Robson with a terrific diving stab to end the inning.
He was Francisco Lindor of the Mets, but back in the 1920s and 30s. So I do think that baseball is a unique sport in the sense that you mentioned it does have this rich history of numbers. And the numbers, they have meaning. They're a way that we can kind of place players within the fabric, the tapestry of the history of the game. And that's another one of the injustices of the segregation of baseball in the early part of the 20th century is that these names are not part of that tapestry. And that's something that I think it was a long overdue decision to kind of get at.
Right. And like, I'm not even the biggest sports fan in the world, but I grew up knowing that Babe Ruth had 714 home runs, that Hank Aaron had 755, Ted Williams batted 406 in a year. Like, these are just things you knew because you could compare your favorite players now and then because they played the same game. Like, and they were all playing like 150, 160 some odd games a year. So the seasons looked the same. That's not necessarily the case for these other leagues. So what do you do? Like, how do you treat all these players that were not able to be on the same field to play?
Yeah, well, the conditions of the Negro Leagues, because they were constantly sort of strapped for cash and unable to kind of have the same amenities or stadiums and facilities as their white peers, they played shorter schedules. You know, Josh Gibson on his home run plaque, it says he hit over 800 home runs in professional baseball. Sadly, not all of those home runs will ultimately be included in the numbers that get put toward the record books in Major League Baseball, because a lot of those are kind of lost to history, or they happened in exhibition games or games against other leagues outside the seven that are being considered.
On one hand, it's an acknowledgement that baseball played by black people and with black people because of segregation was never inferior to games played with all white talent. On the other, it's typically arrogant to act as what black folks did didn't truly matter until white people said so.
You know, many people have raised the valid question of, should Major League Baseball even try to do this? Is this just kind of whitewashing the history of the game? What we're trying to do is sort of just highlight, here are the types of talents that Major League Baseball willingly deprived itself of allowing to play in the major leagues.
Ace pitcher Ray Brown anchored the rotation of the Homestead Grays during its Negro National League dynasty year. Satchel Paige named Judd Boojum Wilson one of the two toughest hitters he ever faced. As for Judd, he didn't care who was on the mound. Negro League pitchers, white major league hurlers, they all looked the same to me.
Certain names jumped out to me that I hadn't necessarily heard of or didn't know enough about. And when you see both their stats and also the great players that come up as their most similar comparisons, it really strikes a chord with you. And you're like, why haven't I heard of this guy?
Josh Gibson was the greatest power hitter in Black baseball. In 60 recorded at-bats against big league pitching, Gibson batted .426. He died just 3 months before the integration of baseball in the major leagues.
And I think that that's the story of the Negro Leagues in a lot of ways, is that it was filled with all of these great, talented players that were not given the chance to become household names for even hardcore baseball fans. So I hope that it's a starting point, not an ending point, and kind of creates conversation rather than just, you know, kind of a cold statistical exercise and, you know, who was the best player. That's a very small part of what we're trying to do here.
Right, that a little leaguer in 2021 could grow up thinking, you know, I want to be like Mike Trout, or I want to be like Dobie Moore, Cristobal Torriente.
Yes.
That is part of the legacy of the game going forward. All right, Neil Payne from 538. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
And one last thing. Earlier this week, people in the Bronx did a double take as they watched New York police officers walking along with a robotic police dog.
This dog can be sent to dangerous situations and help protect officers.
It is covered with cameras and lights.
It'll be able to open doors and move objects.
You might have seen this. If not, you've definitely seen this type of robot before from Boston Dynamics. It's like a spring-loaded terrier, just it's made out of metal and missing a head. Its inventors call it Spot. A lot of other people call it terrifying.
This all looks like great fun until they switch on
until
the grid and they take over.
After all, to have a robot prowling down your street or your hallway, wordlessly watching you, recording you, this is not your traditional German Shepherd. And while locals were drawing comparisons to Minority Report and District 9, a group of artists was allowing people to turn one of these dogs into a gun-wielding menace. This was a project from a group that calls themselves Mischief, that questions our relationship to tech. This group bought a Boston Dynamics robot dog. They got one themselves, they stuck a paintball gun on its back, and locked him in a mini art gallery. Then, using a computer system, they allowed anyone who wanted to take control of the robot and start shooting. Their message was simple. Despite the quirkiness of seeing Spot run, this is a dangerous future we're galloping into. When Boston Dynamics found out about this whole thing, they seemed pretty horrified and wrote a statement saying this provocative art installation fundamentally misrepresents how their robots are being used to improve our lives. They say this might actually violate their terms of use, which means this version of Spot won't be repaired or updated. Mischief seems fine with that. They say once police unions figure out how robots will take their jobs, their work is done. See Brad awkwardly backing away if he sees one of these robot dogs in real life. Also, see Brad take a day off. I will be out tomorrow. My buddy Michelle Franzen is in. In the meantime, all these stories on abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you later.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.